So what is meditation really? It's not what you think.
You think of the word rain, recognition, acceptance, interest, and non-identification.
We learn to recognize awareness or mindfulness as an easeful and natural state of mind.
Hey everybody out there, how you doing? Hope you're doing okay out there on your lockdown here during this COVID-19 pandemic. I'm out here in the rural western slope of the Rocky Mountains at my house in Paonia. And another edition of Dave Smith podcast here. Dave Smith Dharma for some of you. Dave Smith Patreon podcast for some of you, however you're listening. Thank you for joining me. Here we have a really interesting interview, one I'm very happy to put out with my good friend, my recent friend, George Hoffman, who I met just before this whole pandemic thing kicked in. I was down in Santa Fe, New Mexico at the Upaya Zen Center, taking part in a course called Autonomy, Imagination, and Care with a Buddhist teacher, Stephen Batchelor, who I've spoken about many times. And I met George on this retreat and we became fast friends. A very interesting character, somebody who has struggled a lot of his adult life with bipolar disorder. He talks about that here in the interview and how he struggled, what his struggle and process was with bipolar disorder. His ability to find proper medication and cognitive behavioral therapy, ultimately leading him to Christian centering prayer meditation, Zen meditation, mindfulness meditation, Dharma practice, all these good things. He's recently written a book, which he speaks about, and is writing on some other books. He has some blogs. He teaches meditation. He's a super cool guy living in Philadelphia, PA. So we get a little chance to hear from his story and his work that he does. And for anybody out there who has had struggle with mental illness in the current climate, past experiences, present experiences, I think you can learn a lot here from what George has to say. So we're going to welcome George here now and hope you enjoy the podcast and we'll see y'all soon. Later.
The Buddha's enlightenment was his awakening, his understanding, his insight into the ultimate mental reality, into truth with a capital T. None of that language is...
All right. Welcome to Dave Smith Patreon podcast. I'm here with my good friend George Hoffman, who's with us today from Philadelphia. Hello, George.
Hi, Dave. How you doing?
I'm doing good. It's good to have you on here.
Thanks.
So just to reiterate, you know, I met George about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, before the COVID-19 scenario kicked in at a retreat at the Upaya Zen Center with Stephen Batchelor. And during that retreat, we got to do some small groups together and we got to become pretty friendly pretty fast. And he's got a very interesting story in the way that he holds his practice of meditation and mindfulness. He's also a writer and he's somebody who has a lot of interesting things to say. As many of you know, I have a background in substance abuse and mental health work and doing mindfulness and emotional intelligence work in this sector. So I'm really happy to have somebody who's got direct experience with it. So George, just to begin, could you just tell us a little bit about your mental health background? I know you mentioned bipolar disorder. What was your experience living in that kind of psychological framework? And just tell us a little bit about your history that brings you into the work that you do now.
Sure. The mental illness, the bipolar disorder, probably first arose late high school, early college. But I was blue collar kid, New Jersey. Nobody knew about psychiatrists or anything. So went untreated and then leveled out through my 20s. There was a lot of hypomania and it actually fueled some success in business. But then when I hit 29, mania started. I was treated for depression, actually, which was the wrong thing to treat me for. The drugs for depression threw me into the psychotic mania. And it was just a terrible experience, just seeing things, haunting cemeteries. I mean, just ruining relationships, wasting money. and finally ended up in a hospital. I had put in a gun permit on my 31st birthday, and I was going to end it all. But there was a 5-day waiting period. And before the waiting period was up, I was admitted to a psychiatric hospital. And that started a long number of years in and out of hospitals, electroconvulsive therapy, all sorts of draconian treatment, until finally the medication started to, the proper medication was prescribed. And as I got stable, then I added meditation to that regimen and been fairly well with no significant episodes since.
So that's interesting. So looking back, having a mindfulness-based kind of framework now, can you just histrionically, can you, as you go back and think about what were some of the, so you were really successful, which a lot of times that bipolar mania can actually be a pretty useful tool. And so what were some of the things that were happening in your mind now that you can identify that really, could you just talk a little bit about the kind of direct experience of living in a mind with that disorder?
Sure. It was, there was a lot of religiosity in my mania. I was brought up Catholic, and, you know, the whole idea of saints and everything. Well, I got to the point where it was like I was seeing saints and personally interacting with them. Like, I mentioned cemetery.
Like really seeing them, like really thinking
like
they were
really seeing, really seeing them and conversing with them. I saw, there was a period when everyone I saw, I imagine I saw, it was real to me at the time, that they were dead. They were decaying flesh and they were zombie-like. And this was years before Walking Dead and all the current zombie craze and everything. Wow. I spent a lot of times in cemeteries, you know, just looking at mortuary art and haunting around cemeteries.
Like going to the cemetery on purpose and like walking around and stuff.
Yeah. No, on purpose. Yes, on purpose. Church, started going to mass daily. And doing the divine office, which is a structure of saying different psalms at different times during the day.
Wow.
And what the Catholics call centering prayer, which is actually the same thing as the Zen meditation I came to later. And the funny part of the story is the thing that brought me to meditation was this religiosity. I started to fantasize in psychosis myself a monk, and that was what I saw myself as. That was what I was going to become. And in a very manic episode with these religious embodiment of becoming a monk, I actually went to my first monastery. And that was my first real experience with meditation and meditation instructions, and decided I would become a monk. Well, as I got well, largely because of the meditation, the religiosity fell away. And so did the psychosis. So a lot of the negatives, the mixed episodes, which combine mania and depression.
Right.
And led me to some very dark places. You know, that went away as my practice deepened.
So you talked about suicide. If you don't mind talking about that a little bit, a lot of people I know really struggle, especially right now with what's going on in the COVID. Mm-hmm. When you got to that point, what was going on in your mind then? Was it? How did you come to terms with the fact of like, okay, this is just too bad, I just need to get out of this? Was that clearly thought? Was that mania? Was that depression? What was that decision process like?
The first time when I applied for the gun permit, it was the psychosis. I was a VP of sales at a company, at a financial services company, and the psychosis had led me to try to sabotage the business. I was very wrapped up in the identity of the executive, and I was failing at that. And there was a real sense of losing control of my mind. And I was a person that felt control was very important. So that was more of a surrender, that flirting with suicide at that point.
Right.
Years later, I actually attempted. I took a large overdose, fortunately didn't die, but that was very different. That was an impulsive act.
Yep.
Things were bad with the treatment. I had taken a summer where I went off my meds, which a lot of people with bipolar disorder do. And when I went off my meds, I just plummeted into, again, a mixed episode, which combined depression and mania. And there was one night, it was in August, and I had dinner with my mother and sister, and then went back to my apartment and just figured this isn't worth it at all.
Wow.
Sat down without a note, without anything, got all the pills in the house, a few glasses of water, and just took them all, went to bed, and woke up a couple of days later in the intensive care unit of a hospital.
Who found you?
Let me tell more of the story. It was Wednesday when I did it. Tuesday, I had called my psychiatrist, told her what was happening, and she said, okay, you need to go into the hospital again. On Thursday, I'm working intake, so why don't you come on Thursday?
Oh, you know, well, so.
On Wednesday night is when I did it. My father was going to give me a ride Thursday morning to the hospital to check in. So when they came to the door and I didn't answer, and on the phone I didn't answer, they came in, and my mother actually found me on the bed with aspiration and a mess. Wow. And everything. And I don't know that I'll ever forgive myself for what she saw.
Right. Yeah, that's tough. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. tough. Wow, that's quite it. And then you said there was what? There was that, and then there was a whole bunch of other. How long was the period of sort of the hospitalizations and sort of like you were in this kind of almost like episodic experience that went on for how many years did that go on, and what was that like?
There were 7 hospitalizations over a 5-year period.
Wow.
And the most striking thing about a psychiatric admission is how boring the whole thing is. I mean, you're just in the day room kicking around all day. And then there's this miracle cure. As soon as your insurance runs out, they discharge you to the street. You're fine regardless.
Right.
After the suicide attempt, the hospital I was in didn't have a psych unit, so they just discharged me to the street. And it was 3 days later that I ended up in a psych hospital. But the hospitals, There would be therapy, there would be art therapy, there would be a lot of sitting around doing nothing. And again, there were 7 of those over a 5 or 6 year period.
I don't want to go too far down this road, but I'm just curious, do you think that we've gotten any better in the hospitalization, mental health world about managing these things?
I hope that, there's the phone.
It's all good.
I hope that the stigma may be a little less.
Okay.
Because what really took me down a bad road when I was in my 20s and working successfully in business, this was in 94, so it was before the HIPAA laws,
right,
which protects your information. I was an executive, and I knew that if I had psychiatric treatment on the health insurance, that would be reported back to the HR department of my company.
Yeah, and they don't want you kicking around anymore.
No. And so because of the stigma against mental illness and that reporting of information, I didn't get treatment at all. Knowing that this was when I was seeing things and everything, no treatment at all, and ended up getting committed to a hospital.
Wow.
And that was the first psychiatrist I saw. So today, I hope the stigma is not as bad. A lot of people, especially bipolar disorder, a lot of people talk about it.
Yeah.
And you've got a lot of celebrities talking about it. But knowing people that deal with it in their everyday lives and try to hold jobs, it's still difficult because the stigma is still there.
Yeah.
Insurance still doesn't have parity, even though it's supposed to.
Right.
With mental health and with physical health. So it's still a challenge. Still a challenge to get treatment.
Now, this is often the case with substance abuse, which is my primary background, but when you find yourself sort of waking up to the thing, is there, what's the shame aspect of that, of being, is there any shame component which would maybe keep you from getting help, or just kind of like, oh my God, I'm fucked up?
It's probably a combination of the two. There's certainly an, oh my God, I'm fucked up. And there's fear. There's a lot of fear involved because these episodes, these things are happening and you can't control them. And you don't know on any given day what you're going to be like when you wake up.
Right.
And I rapid cycle. So it was quickly from mania to depression, mixed episodes back and forth. And the whole loss of any control over what we define as self, and the whole idea that yourself is sick, not your pancreas, not your blood pressure,
yeah, your mind,
but your very self is sick. That's really hard to deal with.
Yeah. Wow. So fast forwarding, you obviously at some point came into some sort of psychiatric or medical situation where you got medication that sort of worked. And so could you say, and I think this is really important. I'm much more interested in hearing somebody who's actually had direct experience and sort of the doctor's opinion, if you will. Mm-hmm. What about the combination of medication, and at some point you added meditation? What can you say about the merging of those two things really helped you kind of become the successful person that you are now? What could you say something about the foundational aspect of that, of sort of putting the mind back together in a way?
Yeah, the medication led to a sense of stability. The wild swinging episodes tempered down and they weren't as severe anymore. And that enabled some serious therapy, some psychotherapy, to release some of the negative ideas and some of the fears and some of the thoughts of no control that sometimes precipitated and even aggravated episodes. But it was still a fraught period because there was a lot of waves of episodes and instability, a little bit of psychosis. But I came to meditation, as I mentioned, through this religiosity. But as it became more serious, the practice, and I read a lot. I read a lot of Zen and I read a lot of Benedictine writing. And the idea that you're not your thoughts really started to bring home this combination of the same kind of idea in cognitive behavioral therapy with practical aspect of a practice that you can sit down and do, follow your thoughts and realize that most of the time they have very little truth behind them.
Right.
Especially the judgments we have about ourselves.
Totally.
And so it was stability through the medication and the therapy, and then a practice through meditation to sort of bring to the fore and make real some of the discoveries in psychotherapy.
So what was the timeline on that? Like, so there's the medication. So medication, right? So there's a medication, there's a therapeutic kind of addition, and then there's meditation. What was the timeline? What was the sequence of that?
The medication started in about 94, and I didn't start meditating until about 2000.
So
years of trying back and forth with medication and therapy and everything. And then, you know, when I finally came to meditation 6 years later, and then and since then, you know, for 20 years now, then the real benefits accrued from the meditation and the, you know, the episodes ceased, really.
Yeah, that seems to be the great trifecta of experience with people who have, you know, a whole range of mental health things. It's like medication provides the stability, then the insight that we can get through a therapeutic intervention, and then a practice that supports all of that sort of seems to be what the common landscape now. And I think it's a really, really good one. Therapeutically, what kind of therapies did you engage that you found to be really helpful?
You mean like psychotherapy? Or?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, the University of Pennsylvania, which is where, I mean, I was all over the country for a number of years. When I really started to come together in 99, when I ended up at the University of Pennsylvania in the hospital there, Beck, the guy that developed CBT, was a part of that whole clinic. And so the doctor that I used, they were very much into cognitive behavioral therapy early on.
Sure.
So that was the therapy. It wasn't psychotherapy like Freud. It wasn't going back to childhood or anything like that.
It was a behavioral therapy.
Behavioral and dealing with present problems and how we can manage present problems and what we can learn from that. There was never psychoanalysis.
Sure.
In my experience.
Which is sort of a dying art, I think. I think that they've kind of, for a lot of people who have behavioral health stuff, you know, like not being able to function in the world for a variety of reasons, it seems to be the trend is more that kind of behavioral modification stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. And it's, I mean, the other reason for it, they can see measurable results, they can code it for insurance, and it's very, you know, the science meets the finance, and it makes sense for the people who are paying the bills. Yeah.
Sure. So mindfulness, let's talk about mindfulness. So at some point you started practicing, it sounds like you ended up in a kind of mindfulness practice. What was sort of your What was your entry point to mindfulness? Was it a book? Was it MBSR? What was your introduction to mindfulness? And when did you really start to kind of wake up to the fact of, oh, God, this is going to help?
Yeah, the introduction was through Thomas Merton.
Oh, yeah, cool.
Yeah, the Trappist monk, and he wrote about it. And then he, I guess it was in the 50s, he had conversations with Daisetsu Suzuki, who was one of the early people to bring Zen to the United States. So I read these dialogues between the two of them and started to migrate from the Catholic tradition into the Zen tradition at that point. So that was, it was sort of like an intellectual exercise, my real introduction to mindfulness, more than practice. But then when I actually established the practice and started to realize some of the things that these people were writing about, the nature of thoughts, the nature of the body, when practicing inside the body, you know, then it became a lot more real and a lot more practical at that point. And I still look at it as a practical thing.
Right.
I mean, I've read, we talked about Stephen Batchelor. I'm fascinated with his books. I'm fascinated with the Dharma and learning about the Dharma. But I still, my use of meditation and when I teach other people is very, very, from a very practical standpoint. We're going to use this to help predict oncoming episodes of anxiety, depression, or mania, and then act with an intervention that we've worked out in advance. So the meditation, I do it twice a day for a half hour each time, but it's still more of an idea of management of a mental illness than it is about any idea about enlightenment or anything like that.
I think the Buddha would applaud that. Actually. Mm-hmm. I think he'd be like, finally. You know,
which is why, which, like the idea of mindfulness, I studied with Jon Kabat-Zinn. I studied teaching with him through MBSR. And, you know, the whole idea, they kick around all the time that mindfulness is the non-judgmental awareness of the present moment. You hear that all the time.
That's the dominant paradigm definition for sure.
Sure. The definition I came across, actually, it was a video of Batchelor teaching with John Peacock, the scholar and teacher. Mm-hmm. And Peacock said, mindfulness is the realization of where you are now and where you don't have to be.
Wow.
And that really resonates with me, especially as you apply mindfulness to something very specific, like managing a mental illness.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I think there's a lot. I mean, they did an academic study years ago and they asked all the kind of the world renowned people from Buddhism, from science, and they actually came up with six definitions that were quite oppositional. So I think that, I think the definition that works for each person is the best one because a lot of times we're doing it for different reasons. So, So mindfulness is sort of sounds like where you ended up at some point. What were some of the things about that practice you think that really, and I think this is a really important question, and I think people miss this question. What are the practical applications of mindfulness that you actually would identify?
Probably the earliest one was to stop perseverating. You know, perseveration, where it's the same negative thoughts going over and over and over again.
Sometimes called rumination.
Rumination, absolutely, absolutely. And to cease that early on through meditation by just, first of all, capturing, realizing what you're doing in your mind with the rumination. And then realizing that these thoughts, this rumination is often inaccurate and is fueling negative behavior and emotions, and then training yourself to be able to let that go and not identify with the thoughts any longer. That was the early benefit to meditation for me in treating the bipolar disorder that I have.
Wow.
What came later was discovering that, you know, bipolar disorder, any affective disorders, the mood disorders, whether it's anxiety, depression, or bipolar disorder, they're episodic.
Right.
Usually there are periods where everything's okay and then periods where it all comes apart. And before episodes begin, there's often physical sensations, discomfort in the body that signals something is coming. Thought patterns change slightly that signal something is coming. So what I then developed and where meditation has helped the most is to be able to, through meditation, recognize these early warning signs that an episode is coming and then act to prevent the episode.
So there's like mindful predictors.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's amazing. So moving through the process again, you know, it's always interesting to me how people end up in this kind of, you know, there's lots of doorways in now to the Dharma. And I think it's really cool that, you know, mental health is one of them, and just the suffering of the mind, which is really what the Buddha talked about so much. When did you start to branch, you know, so there was a Zen background, there was some mindfulness. When did you start to look more into mindfulness through a Dharma framework? And what were some of the onsets of that? And could you speak about that some?
Yeah, in the MBSR world, when I was training with Jon Kabat-Zinn and with some people in Philadelphia, they always give you Dharma light.
Yeah.
In, you know, you'll be doing a full day workshop and they'll throw out the full Four Noble Truths and talk a little bit about that.
Oh, wow.
And go on to more of the science-based MBSR. So I sort of grasped onto this idea, the Four Noble Truths, and thought there has to be more to it than this. You know, we suffer, there's a way to prevent suffering, all of that. And sort of to them, it was MBSR is the way to overcome suffering. Well, I discovered the rest of it, the Eightfold Path. There's so much more to that prescription to deal with suffering. So it was in discovering the Eightfold Path that took me deeply into reading things about the Dharma and the primary sources. I mean, what the Buddha said himself, which took me earlier and earlier in the whole Buddhist theology, I guess you can call it, to the Pali Canon. And so it was that reductionism from this idea that meditation solves everything down to the actual ideas behind it.
What was the trail of breadcrumbs you there? So there was Zen, there was mindfulness, MBSR, early canon. What were some of the preliminary books that maybe led you up to sort of some of Stevens and Peacock's ideas? What were some of the pinnacle moments of like, okay, I'm starting to get this?
It was Zen in the beginning, but Zen too skirts much. I mean, you can practice Zen for a lifetime and not deal with the Dharma at all.
That's right. I
mean, yeah. So again, it was curiosity about the Dharma. So it started with some of the Western teachers, you know, some of the big insight names and things. But then I tried to, just like in my reading, when I studied Catholicism, I tried to go to original sources.
Right.
And so I went right to like Red Pine's translations, Bill Porter, Red Pine, of some of the early Buddhist sutras. But from that, when I got lost in that, I just couldn't figure it out.
Right.
And just through some reading and some research, I discovered Stephen Batchelor. Mm-hmm. And then it was his writing that started to bring it all together.
Do you remember what the first book of his that you read was?
Yeah, well, Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist.
Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the first one.
And so reading and studying the stuff, I know that we sat with him in Santa Fe. Was that your first sort of in live session with Stephen, or had you sat with him other places before?
No, that was my first live session with him. Yeah. I had seen some videos and things, but I'd never actually sat with him or done that intense a period of study.
So that was your sort of longest sort of retreat where there was like, you know, and that was retreat light to some degree, but there were hours of the day that was pretty intensive meditation. Was that hard? What was it like for you to be in the retreat context?
Well, I'd done longer retreats before. I'd done longer retreats before. But it was Zen. So they were silent and there might be a Dharma talk. And I would go to a monastery and we would sit for days, session, more or less. Sure. Yeah. So this was the first one that it sort of combined one of the best high level college courses I've ever had practice during the day.
Yeah.
So it was interesting because it was so intellectually stimulating.
Right.
And then they would throw on periods of practice where the idea was to separate yourself from all of that. So it was a real challenge, actually.
Yeah. Yes. And when you start to integrate, and I think this is sort of the goal for me has been integrating the study and the practice. And it's actually really hard to do. So it's like, you know, he gives a lecture, he gives you a bunch of ideas that, you know, stimulate us and we get thinking about them. And then we're asked to kind of see if we can see what's being taught through direct experience, which to me is really the kind of trial and error of Dharma practice.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And, but you know, I've always been maybe a little over intellectualized. So to study with Batchelor, it was fascinating because it was so intellectually challenging.
Yeah.
And it went so far beyond just the Pali Canon. I mean, he talked about Heidegger and great 20th century Western philosophers to bring together that last day when all of a sudden the light bulb went on and everything he'd been saying made sense. Right. And he really spanned. He spanned the intellectual traditions and ideas of mindfulness from many different cultures during those 5 days.
Yeah, and it does show up everywhere. You mentioned Christian centering prayer. When I lived in Nashville, Tennessee, there was a lot of people who were doing that. And I was like, that's just mindfulness. So even the idea and the practice of mindfulness doesn't, you can't really just tie it to the Buddhist tradition.
No, and I still sit with a centering prayer Jesuit group once a month. Yeah, still. And it's funny because it's so similar, because there is the period of silent meditation and there's what's essentially a Dharma talk.
Right.
And it's so similar to a lot of the Buddhist meditation that I've done.
Right. Mm-hmm. If there are differences, what are the differences that you find?
The theology. I mean, the centering prayer groups, especially in the Catholic, they're very idea driven. I mean, there is objective truth.
So at some point you started writing about this stuff as somebody who's been, you know, kind of been affected by it, went through a recovery process, got into meditation, and then, you know, writing about it. What was some of the first sense you got of wanting to write about it? What did you write about? And what's been your process of actually taking this stuff out of your mind and in your body and onto the page?
As I really suffered through mental illness, I used to write about it, wrote poems and biographical things. But as I went deeper and deeper into mindfulness and meditation, and people I studied with encouraged me to teach, then my writing shifted from, you know, poetic prose and things about, you know, the whole idea of mental illness to more practical writing about how some of these concepts I have studied can be applied to help manage mental illness. And that's when the writing became more readable, more serious. And I started blogging and I started putting this together into a book and got a book contract for a big book called Practicing Mental Illness that's coming out next year.
Right.
But from that, we had this fascinating project. My publisher contacted me a few weeks ago and said, can you get out a 20,000 word book in 20 days about using some of your techniques to handle anxiety? And so that book is out now. It's called Resilience, Handling Anxiety in Its Time of Crisis. And actually today, the 15th, is the day that it's published.
That's wild. Yeah, I know. I was happy to be able to read some of that stuff that you sent over and make a plug for it, because I think it's super important. You have this book out now, and could you just talk a little bit about the inspiration for the book? What's in the book? If I get the book, what can I expect? Just talk a little bit about the, you know, what's in the content, especially now in the time of COVID. It's probably very, very relevant. So just tell us about the book.
Yeah, well, the book is really the whole idea of using meditation to help predict episodes. I've written so long for people with serious mental illness. This was sort of a step back from them for something that anybody that deals with anxiety, especially people today with the pandemic who are feeling serious anxiety for the first time and don't know how to handle it. So it's some practical tips as to what anxiety is in the first place, the physiology of it, and how it embodies itself and what it can do to you, ways to notice this through meditation. I give several examples of meditation, from seated meditation to standing meditation, and the incredible power of meditation to notice your moods and your emotions and how they affect you. And then some ways to get further into the roots of what causes your anxiety through meditation. And thereby give you the capacity to handle it. And it's in a very short work. It's a pretty short book, but I think we've pulled it all together.
One thing that I noticed when I read it, and I read through it relatively quickly, but I've read about a lot of this stuff that I really appreciated, is there tends to be in your writing around this particular topic a very undertone and a theme of normalizing the experience and actually destigmatizing the experience in a way that takes the pathology out of it. And I just want to know if you could say something about that. Was that intentional or is that just how you think of it? Because I really got the sense of that. And I think one of the biggest problems with mental health and behavioral health and substance abuse and all that stuff is the stigma associated with it. So having a book that I think, you know, counteracts that in a way is really, really helpful. So was that intentional? And what's been your process with that?
So much of what I've read has either been very clinical. It's from people who treat mental illness. Doctors, therapists don't have that firsthand experience, or it's scattershot. There's so many case studies presented in a depersonalized way that it's hard to grab onto a story and really relate and say, yeah, that sounds like me. Mm-hmm. So I try to just present mostly my own experience in a raw, just lay it out there, honest way. And then within that story, present some of the methods that you can manage a mental illness or anxiety or something like that, instead of getting clinical with study after study after study, or two or three pages of somebody's story that's not fully developed. So there's sort of like, the books are sort of like a combination of memoir and self-help.
Right.
In a way. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, my point is I can destigmatize it by coming out and saying, this is what my experience is. These are the mistakes I've made. These are the good things I've been able to do. A lot of people, whether it's trying to hold a job or manage a family or something, don't have the luxury to be able to tell their full story and be fully honest in public with that experience.
You know, it's funny, to revisit this idea, it sounds like, you know, you're kind of talking about the story laid out through the lens of a Four Noble Truths experience. Like, you know, there was some tragedy to it and there were some causes to it. And then there was some freedom from it. And then there's a process to that. So it's almost like, it's funny. And I don't know how much of that thinking went into it, but it's interesting that that framework of this task-based model is really applicable to such a range of our experience.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because I hadn't actually consciously thought that. But now thinking of it, that's exactly there. Right. So it was probably the study that influenced that. But when you say task-based model, that was the thing about the bachelor seminar that moved me the most.
Right.
The whole idea of tasks.
Right.
And that it's the work that we put into it that is both teaching us and is the reward inevitably, not something that comes because of the tasks, but performing the tasks themselves.
Right. Which is interesting because I think the one topic that doesn't get the airtime it deserves in the arena of sort of a secular mindfulness thing, and you know, is the Eightfold Path perspective, that the meditative, the contemplative path factors are built on concentration, effort, and mindfulness. And the task-based model is pointing to an effort like, man, this is going to be some work. And so that there's a recognition of that work. There's the performance of that work and there's the accomplishment of that work. I think really puts it into our hands of like, which I actually like, because it's like, it's telling me I can do something and I can know how to do something. And that just knowing something a lot of times don't mean shit.
Exactly. And again, the work itself, which is why both the Zen monasteries I've been to and the Benedictine monasteries I've been to, you're put to work every day. I always end up cleaning bathrooms, but you're put to work. And even at the bachelor seminar, we had work every day. And in the big book that's coming out next year, I have a section on meaningful work that carries the same weight as the section on meditation, because it's everything can be a practice. And I think if we make everything a practice, then we can most learn about ourselves and be most prepared to be a positive impact on the other people in our life.
Right. And if you want to, we have a little bit of time. I'm curious to see what you could say, because you're one thing I like about your process, which is true with most processes, your timeline's kind of all, it's like a Tarantino movie, right? It's like, right, you know, it's back and forth and back and forth, but you keep mentioning this big book. So you started this book, your publisher asked you to write this other book, which you just talked about, and which means this other book is going to be finished and put out later. Could you tell us about that book and what's in there? And
yeah, it's called Practicing Mental Illness. And again, it has a lot of my personal story in it, but it breaks up the treatment through practice for a mental illness into three parts. The first is meditation. The second is movement, because movement practice, everything from the actual meditation possible in movement to the idea that, especially with mental illness, there are so many comorbid conditions that are the ones that end up killing us in the
right.
end. The cardiac problems, the diabetes, things like that, that through movement practice we can teach and gain some control over our lives. Because sometimes when our minds are spinning out of control, we can still do something with our physical fitness as a simple practice. And then the third section is work and using work as a practice.
That's great. And Right Livelihood turns out to be a Buddhist teaching, it turns out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting because when you talk about the comorbidity, you know, being in the substance abuse world, a lot of times addiction or substance abuse is just an antidote to a mental illness problem. And so yes. it sounds like, interestingly enough, I don't know, you didn't mention that, I don't know if that's true for you, but in your episodic bipolar years, did you turn to substances at all, or was that part of the equation, or did you use other things?
I did. There was the summer before my suicide attempt, the one with the pills that was the serious one, I was abusing Klonopin,
yeah,
which had been prescribed as a drug to me largely for anxiety.
Yeah, right.
But I got to the point where I had stopped the other psychotropic medication entirely. And the Klonopin, I was actually crushing it with a cocktail glass, snorting it, and then chasing it with tequila. And I did that for several months. When I was younger, I had a problem with meth.
Oh.
We used to call it crank.
Yeah.
Back then. And I used that. And actually I was able to pull it together enough. I grew up in Philadelphia and I lived here. And this is where I was using the meth and running in those circles. And I had enough wherewithal to just stop and moved to Florida, where I didn't have the supply and it wasn't at that point in time as popular.
Yeah.
And was able to deal with it that way instead of going into treatment, just leaving the area entirely.
Sure.
But yeah, there's definitely been some substance abuse in this history. And I think in terms of self-medication for people with mental illness, it's a very common experience.
Yeah, it's probably the predominant common experience. It's sort of what, you know, drugs, unfortunately, they do work for a short period of time.
Yeah. And the other thing, I mean, with bipolar disorder, the mania is so wonderful until it's not.
Right.
And so oftentimes we turn to substances that can drive us into that wonderful feeling of low-grade mania. Again, until it's not, because whether it's the substances eventually get us and tear life apart, or the mania itself will do that. But there are feelings about it that I have to be honest, I miss still.
Sure.
Yeah.
So just before we wrap up, I know that you do a lot of other stuff on the day to day. Where can listeners and where can we find you on the day to day? I know you write some blogs. Can you just talk a little bit about the blogs that you write, what you write in those blogs for people who just maybe don't want to read a whole book or want to get introduced to your writing and some of your ideas?
Sure. I have a website, practicingmentalillness.com, that connects to one blog. But my more popular work, Psych Central, which is the big website that's an aggregator of blogs and everything. On Psych Central, I have a blog called Getting Older with Bipolar that deals with everything from meditation to aging and mental illness issues. And so Getting Older with Bipolar is probably the best place to find me and to be exposed to my work. So if you go on Psych Central, the website, and just type in Getting Older with Bipolar, there's about 150 posts up.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And so what do you, so lastly, I always like to ask people this last question, moving into the future and doing what you've done and where you've come from, what is it that you're most excited about in the arena of sort of Dharma and mindfulness and writing and mental health? What, is there anything that your mind is kind of leaning towards and where you could leave us with some optimism or something that you feel enthusiastic about at the moment?
Yeah, there is. And in the Dharma, it's still, and interestingly enough, even if you go into the centering prayer tradition and read deep enough into literature, you'll find the same exact place where our self is really a layering of experience. And I think if we realize how important experience is to our definition of self, we can both fully enjoy the experience or suffer through the experience and have that full range of emotions in a safe enough place that it's not attacking our whole idea of self and who we are. So we can live a life of experience and really reside in that experience without having it damage the idea of whatever self we have built up. And my reading in the Dharma and my reading in the Catholic tradition as well follows that path. The whole nature of experience versus the nature of belief. Right. Actual practice versus assumptions.
Right. Yeah, that's awesome. All right, well, that's George Hoffman in Philadelphia, PA.
Thanks, Dave.
Stay safe out there, and we'll put a bunch of links to the stuff you mentioned here in the blog post for those of you who want to get the book and check out more about what you're doing. So thank you for your time today. I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thanks, Dave. Great experience. Thank you.